May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, as the court is aware, this case involves a federal motor vehicle collision that occurred in February of 2010, where the plaintiff that I represent was in the course and scope of his employment. And we're concerned about the interplay between 3902 of Title 18 and Section 2363 of Title 19 and their competing public policies. We have argued and continue to argue that the decision of the trial court is erroneous in that it placed the public policy of 2363 over the public policy of 18 Delaware Code Section 3902. And my client is continuing to receive ongoing death benefits or wants to continue to receive those benefits, but is prohibited because of the workers' compensation lien and credit at issue in this case. I would just briefly like to take the court back to the underlying and well-avowed purpose of 18 Delaware Code Section 3902, which is to fully compensate innocent injured drivers who are injured by the negligence of uninsured drivers, to making sure that there's a fund to protect them and their losses. The court has avowed over the last 20 or 25 years that any limitation, restriction on the scope of uninsured motorist coverage is invalid unless it's specifically authorized by that statute. More importantly, I think, for the purposes of this case, is UM coverage is personal to the insured. That is, it is not location-specific, it is not vehicle-specific, and it is not specific to recovery contingent upon the manner of the injury. And if any argument to that is made, it has been determined in prior decisions to be inimical to the purpose of 3902. And I think that that's essentially what we're dealing with in this particular case. If you look at the argument advanced by the court below and also by the defense, what we're dealing with is a competition between the strong public policy of UM, of the UM statute, versus the public policy set forth in 2363. And what I mean by that is what the defense now wants to argue in this particular case is we need to have a limitation on recovery premised upon what vehicle you're in.
And well, if I understand you right, your position is that in any circumstance where there's a conflict between 2363 and 3902,
yes, sir.
2363, which is the UM provision, trumps.
Yes. I believe 2363 is the workers' comp provision, Your Honor, but I do believe okay. that the court is correct, but it's our position that the scope of the UM coverage is broader and entitled to more deference than 2363. And in fact, this court said that same thing in Adams versus Delmarva. This identical policy language.
Well, so you're asking us to hold as an absolute unqualified rule of law that that's the case, and therefore it doesn't make any difference, you know, whether the policy, the UM policy, was acquired or paid for by the employee or by the employer. Doesn't make any difference.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think recognizing that Harris was decided, you know, close to 30 years ago, the uninsured motorist policy has evolved, as this court has noted. And just to give the court a hypothetical, let's suppose that one of your honors was on your way to an argument in Wilmington after this, and your car broke down, and you asked.
Let me stop you for a moment.
Sure.
Because the argument that you're making here, I haven't seen anything in the briefs that supports you know, that particular argument in that stark form. That is, that regardless of circumstances, 3902 always trumps 2363. So help us get there.
Well, Your Honor, what I mean is that in the context of determining who pays, how you're injured, it doesn't matter for the purposes of the scope of uninsured motorist coverage.
I know you argue that, but that has to be based, that argument has to be based either on a provision of a statute or prior case law or public policy.
Correct.
What do you rely on?
I rely on the Adams case. We also rely upon the public policy of 18 Delaware Code Section 3902 because what car you're in or who pays your premium shouldn't matter. And if I may, to continue with my hypothetical, if one of your honors was driving in my car and you were in the course and scope of your employment with the state and an uninsured driver impacted my car, you would be permitted to make a claim for your injuries under my uninsured motorist policy. You didn't pay a dime for that coverage. You never benefit or bargained for that benefit. And yet, if the court agrees with the decision below, what would occur is that workers' comp carrier who then pays your benefits could then turn around and say, the court did not pay for that coverage, and we have the right to subrogate against that because that is the universal distinction that exists in this particular case. And I think the argument is who pays more important than the policy, public policy of 18 Delaware Code Section 3902. And we don't believe that it is. And it's never been determined in this state that the scope of the coverage is subrogated to or subordinated to the specific facts of the case. And I think that
hasn't been determined one way or the other.
Well, not on this particular fact, Your Honor, but I think if the court understands, and I'm sure it does, the Adams decision.
But your argument is that it doesn't depend on the particular facts.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You're basically making an argument that freezes one statute in place above another. Period.
Well, I think the court has to evaluate what public policy is more important.
Okay.
And I think that the court already did that in part in Adams. And the court, because the identical language in the Adams case was in front of the court, the same policy language, word for word, that's in this case. And what the court did in Adams in overturning Harris was looked at the fact that who paid the premium was important because it wasn't fair.
But it really doesn't, but you're not relying on that.
No, I'm not, Your Honor, but what I'm relying upon is if the court looks at the big picture of that and says, wait a minute, what's more important? The scope of UM coverage or the alleged public policy purpose of 2363, the court felt that the public policy of 3902 is more important. Otherwise, the court would not have decided that decision the way it did.
Well, public policy may be what we have to resort to, but there's also, before you get to that, the text of the statute or
yes, sir.
Statutes. And one could argue that because the Section 2363, which is the workers' comp priority reimbursement provision,
yes, sir.
Is a very particularized statute as distinguished from the UM statute, which is much more broad, that the more particular statute should take precedence over the broader one.
Well,
because the legislature intended it, even though it didn't connect the dots as it probably should have.
Right. Well, I do believe that, and this court certainly didn't say that in the Adams decision. And the prior decisions, older than Adams and Harris and Lane, in the three cases that dealt with the employer-paid coverage, never involved this particular contract language. And I just wanted to, if I could, quote a line from the Adams decision where the court specifically said the language of Adams uninsured motorist coverage precluding its applicability to claims made by workers' compensation carriers promotes that public safety by preventing the diminution of additional funds which Adams sought by contract to provide as protection for himself and his family. And that policy still exists today because of the fact that Mr. Sternfels did not pay for this coverage. His employer did. His employer thought to purchase this coverage.
I thought my question was addressed in terms of statutory text, and I was expecting that you would respond that way. Instead, you jump back to public policy.
Well, I do believe that, in trying to answer your question, I do believe that the court in Adams looked at that statutory language. Otherwise, it would not have reached this decision.
But what did Adam say about the statutory language?
Well,
distinguished from the public policy.
Okay. Well, Your Honor, that specific language of addressing in that form was not at issue. But I think what the court said was 3902, public policy is stronger than 2363. But to answer your question, I do think that, as noted in the footnote in the Hearst case, there is language in the last sentence of 2363 that was amended in 1993 that indicates that reimbursement shall only be had for third-party liability insurance. And that's what it says. And I don't intend to argue that I certainly know more about statutory construction than this court, but that was the meaning given to that change in the statute in 1993 by this court in Hearst. And I have reviewed the legislative history, I've reviewed the synopsis, and I'll submit to you it is difficult to tell exactly if there was a extended debate on whether or not that was intended, but whether or not, if it was intended or not, that's what it says. And I think that there is no reason for this court to disturb the footnote in Hearst, because that is the plain language of the statute. And it does seem, as was noted in the Hearst decision, that...
Can you explain to me, the entire phrase, except that for items of expense which are precluded from being introduced into evidence at trial by 2118 and Title 21, which means PIP.
Yes, sir.
Reimbursement shall be had only from the third-party liability insurer and shall be limited to the maximum amounts of the third party's liability insurance coverage available for the injured party after the injured party's claim has been settled or otherwise resolved. So what's your interpretation of what that means?
Well, the question is, does the last phrase, is that modified the except part, or is that a separate provision from that? I know there's a comma that's separating it. But I think the way it was read in Hearst was this statute has been changed, and it says reimbursement. It doesn't say reimbursement for these benefits. It doesn't say reimbursement for PIP. It says reimbursement. And it specifically says third-party liability insurance carrier up to their maximal. And I gave the court a hypothetical when we argued this last time, was that let's suppose that the tortfeasor, we paid policy limits, the liability carrier did, and then we sued the tortfeasor individually for another $20,000 because of the damages and how badly the person was hurt, and they paid out of pocket. Could the comp carrier subrogate directly against the tortfeasor on this statute? I don't think so, because it says it's limited to the amount that the third-party liability insurer paid. And so I think that if the court, it depends upon how you read the rest of that sentence as to whether or not it in turn is modified as a part and parcel of the except, or whether or not it says reimbursement, because that reimbursement shall be had only. It doesn't limit it. Just, I think that it would be more clear, Your Honors, if the General Assembly had said reimbursement for those benefits shall only be had.
Well, what's the significance of the fact that after Hearst was written and the statute was construed, the General Assembly hasn't amended the statute to provide for any exceptions?
Well, I think that's important, because I think that that underscores that it's interpreted the way that I'm interpreting it and the way that the court interpreted it in Hearst. And frankly, the fact that this has continued to exist the way it is, I think that underscores that the way it's written, whether it was intended or not. I understand that this was a change to offset PIP versus comp. But the language was written as it's written, and I think that since it hasn't been changed, I think the argument is that provision means what it says. But I don't want the court to think that the plaintiff believes that even if you interpret the statute the way the defense wants you, the appellee wants you to interpret it, we still believe that this court must overturn Harris and reaffirm and broaden Adams, because if the court were to say, no, let's go back and leave the decision the way it is for the trial court, you're then going to have to deal with cases in the future about who pays for the coverage. The hypothetical I gave this court, the workers' comp carrier now is going to be able to say, if you affirm this decision, well, who pays matters. And not only that, whose car you're in matters. And how the collision occurred matters. And you're going to have further limits on the scope of the coverage. So whether we get there this year or 5 years from now, the decision of Frank and Hearst and the scope of the UM coverage, and there's been no change to the UM statute, that coverage is going to get changed as time goes on if the court decides that Harris is right and it should be extended. And I think that's something that the court is going to have to wrestle with in the future. I do believe that...
Explain to us why that would be a bad result, given all the cases we say in that you're entitled to pay for extra insurance and to protect yourself. And we have a whole line of cases that say, you know, the astute consumer who pays for additional coverage is to be entitled to that coverage, and that coverage goes with him.
Right.
So to that extent, we're talking about a direct relationship between who pays and the coverage, and moving the coverage around. If we get into a situation where you didn't pay, why isn't it logical that maybe there would be a different result?
Well, because I think the problem is, Your Honor, is what the law is if you are in my car and I happen to have a lot of insurance and workers' comp had a lien, you're going to get the benefit of the dumb luck of being in someone else's car that had a lot of insurance. In this particular case, these two drug counselors that were killed, their employer decided to buy $1 million in uninsured motorist coverage to protect, presumably, its employees. Whether that was fortuitous or not, that's what occurred. And because they were in that car, and if they had had a smaller policy, we would have obviously a different result in terms of the amounts. But the way the situation is currently is, you do get the benefit of your bargain. That's great that the court has always said you're entitled to that. But also, by luck, UM coverage follows the vehicle, and it's personal to you. And if you're in my vehicle, you can access that insurance, and then you have the right to access your own. And that's what occurred in this case. What the comp carrier is saying is that because this is employer-paid coverage, the rules are different, and the scope of the coverage in 3902 isn't as broad as it should be. And I think that's the dilemma that the defendant has. This is going to be a limit on the scope of the coverage, because we're going to now say, wait a minute, you don't get what you thought you got, even though someone else paid for it, because you are, in fact, in someone else's car. And this court has never determined that what car you're in determines what benefits you get. And I think that's where this is going if this continues to, if this decision gets affirmed. And I think that the court should evaluate the public policy of 3902 higher than the public policy of 2363, just like it did in Adams, and just like it did in the collateral source case, where the court thought that comp benefits in the Miller case should not come into evidence that they were paid, because the purpose of 183902, again, I know that was personally paid coverage. But there have been a number of jurisdictions all over the country that have indicated that uninsured motorist coverage has a broad purpose. And I'm at my time here, and I'll save the rest of my rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Daniel McKenty on behalf of National Union Fire Insurance Company, FLA. At this time, I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Catherine Hemming.
You're welcome.
When this case was argued last time before this Court, appellant was making the argument that an exclusionary clause inside the UIM policy should trump the workers' compensation statute that allows for subrogation of its interests. We heard a different argument today, a public policy argument. But the fact of the matter is, the cases that are cited in appellant's brief as being in favor...
They also relied on statutory language, didn't they? Not just public policy.
Well, they relied on the... What we just heard was the public policy concerns of 3902 versus 2363E, I think, was the main thrust of appellant's argument today. And his argument was such that, you know, one necessarily trumps the other. I take issue with that in the sense that we're talking about two very different things, and I think it has a very real effect on what is likely to occur if this court overrules the Harris case, which is what appellant is asking this court to do. As an employer, I have to buy workers' compensation insurance. I don't have to buy uninsured motorist coverage for the vehicles. And quite frankly, if this court rules in appellant's favor, I don't know why any employer would buy underinsured motorist coverage. If I have a fleet of delivery trucks, say, I'm a produce distributor, and the only thing those trucks are going to be used for is distributing produce to grocery stores, my clients, and the only people that are going to drive those delivery trucks are my employees, I have workers' compensation insurance. They're going to be hurt in the course and scope of their employment. They're not allowed to drive the vehicles home. Why would I buy underinsured motorist coverage? Rather than
to provide extra protections for employees. Isn't that the rationale?
Right. But if I'm self-insured for workers' compensation, or even if I'm insured and I'm paying a premium or I have a self-insured retention and that workers' compensation carrier cannot assert its lien against the UIM proceeds, then there's no benefit to me as an employer other than this is something that I want to do. But here you've got, now we have a situation where you've got a statute, 2363E, that says any recovery. And when this court, when the Superior Court in State versus Donahue, and when this court in Harris versus Newcastle County took a look at the Supreme Court of Kansas case upon which appellant most relies, the Knight case, he distills all of the cases, he says it's best enunciated in Knight. Well, the Superior Court rejected the analysis of the Knight case from the Supreme Court of Kansas. And then in the Harris versus Newcastle County case, they rejected the arguments made in Knight, and Knight is a specific footnote in the Harris versus Newcastle County case. So this court has already heard the arguments and seen the case law that appellant has put forth in its brief. And in the Superior Court case and then subsequently a Supreme Court case, it's considered those arguments and it's rejected it.
I have two questions.
Yes, Justice Berger.
First, would you agree that even under your interpretation of the law, if the car had been the employee's car and the employee had purchased underinsured coverage, that there would be no set off or reimbursement as to that coverage?
Certainly, and that's the Adams case.
Okay. So it's all because the employer bought this insurance that it should be set off.
Yes.
Right? And you also said that there would be no reason for you as an employer to buy uninsured motorist coverage if there's going to be no set-off. Help me to understand that. Employers don't provide a variety of safeguards for their employees.
They may or may not, but underinsured motorist coverage is elective.
Right.
Workers' compensation is not.
So are health plans and, you know, 401ks
right.
or whatever. You know, there are a lot of, quote, benefits that an employer decides to provide or not provide.
Correct.
Uninsured motorist coverage for cars that are going to be used by your employees is either something the employer chooses to provide or not, right?
Correct. And that's my point, is when you're looking at the public policy considerations, you're looking at one, you're looking at mandatory insurance that an employer has to provide under law. Okay. The other is you're looking at an insurance policy that he may or he or she may or may not choose to provide.
I understood your argument. It was you have to buy workman's compensation insurance, and to the extent you have to buy it, your premium is calculated based on your experience. So the higher claims that you pay, the higher your premium is going to be. At least with regard to motor vehicles, you have an opportunity to keep your workman's compensation premium low by having uninsured motorist coverage that would offset the claim, and then you can make the argument to your employer that your premium for workman's comp shouldn't go up because they really weren't out of pocket when they could make their claim. Is that right?
Right, but in appellant's argument, I would assume that figures into the premium calculation just like you're assuming. I don't know, but yeah, that makes sense, certainly. That certainly makes sense. But if we say that this clause in the Philadelphia Insurance Company's uninsured motorist policy which prohibits a workers' compensation carrier from subrogating to the UIM policy is valid, we've done a number of things. First of all, we've taken an insurance clause and we've decided that it's going to trump a statute. And there's no support in appellant's brief that a restrictive clause in an insurance policy trumps a statute.
But that's only if the statute is interpreted as you suggest.
Well, that's true, but that's currently how it's being interpreted under the Harris case versus Newcastle County. That's the current interpretation of that statute.
Well, what about Hearst?
Hearst is a footnote. Hearst is a case that doesn't deal with workers' compensation at all. There's no discussion of workers' compensation insurance coverage in Hearst. Hearst is strictly a UIM, UM decision that talks about credits between and among the UIM policies. The Hearst language, the footnote number two in Hearst, and if you'll give me a second, I'll pull it out here. Only concerns PIP monies, and in that session of the State Assembly, I believe the only other correction made to an existing statute was to the PIP statute as well. They reformed both of them.
Well, the footnote doesn't even mention PIP, does it?
The Hearst case?
Footnote number two?
Footnote number two doesn't, but the 1993 amendment, which I'm assuming it's referring to, which
well,
we're
I
all
understand
assuming.
Your position is footnote number two, as written in Hearst, an accurate or inaccurate statement of the law?
It is an inaccurate statement of the law.
And why is that?
Because the 1993 amendment only affects the workers' compensation company's claim on monies that were either paid by PIP or were otherwise payable by PIP. And what it says is this. You're the workers' compensation carrier. You have a right of subrogation. But your right does not reach monies that the plaintiff could not receive from the tortfeasor. In other words, the plaintiff's going to receive a recovery, and the workers' compensation carrier is going to assert a lien against that. So the 1993 amendment says, well, wait a minute. It's unfair if the workers' if as part of their lien, the workers' compensation the lien has monies that the plaintiff wasn't able to board against the tortfeasor because they're excluded by PIP by 2118. And so we're not going to let you, as the workers' compensation carrier, collect monies that were paid by PIP or PIP eligible out of your lien that you're going to take from the plaintiff because the plaintiff couldn't get them from the tortfeasor. Okay, those are limited to the extent of the tortfeasor's liability carrier, if any is available after the case is settled or resolved. And that makes perfect sense. But that's all it does. The language, any recovery in 2363E, which this court looked at very extensively in the Harris case, is still in 2363E today. That language upon which Harris is hinged has never been disturbed by the 1993 amendment to 2363E. So when the footnote 2 broadens it out entirely and says, we note that the General Assembly has eliminated the ability of an employer's workers' compensation carrier to assert a priority lien against an injured employee's right to payment pursuant to the employer's uninsured motorist coverage. Yes, that is an incorrect statement of the law, because the 1993 amendment simply doesn't do that. It makes a very, I think, wise amendment that says the workers' compensation carrier can't get from the plaintiff in its lien what the plaintiff could not have gotten from the tortfeasor in a tort action.
What do we do with the case law that says when this court announces a rule and the General Assembly does nothing, that they agree with it?
Could you give me that one more time?
What do we do with the case law that this court's interpretation of a statute, if the General Assembly does nothing to correct it, that our interpretation is consistent with their intent?
Well, it's a footnote to a case that doesn't deal with workers' compensation. So I'm not sure how bound the court considers itself with respect to the footnote in the case. I think we'd have another problem if Hearst dealt with the issue and that decision, or that language rather, existed within the main body of the decision, but it doesn't. As I've read Hearst 100 times at least, and it's a footnote that it's certainly there. I'm not sure why it's there in the context of the Hearst case, because you've got no discussion whatsoever throughout Hearst of anything having to do with workers' compensation coverage to begin with, or 2363E, which is the section of the statute that allows for the subrogable interest. I think that's the best answer I can give you. One of the problems, big problems, with appellant's position is that it allows for double recovery. Were you to rule in appellant's favor, we would be in a situation where there would be double recovery for the claimant, and that is expressly prohibited in the statutory construction of 2363E. And let me explain what I mean by double recovery. Workers' compensation coverage pays medical bills and it pays wages. If there's no lien available against the UIM policy, there's nothing to prohibit the claimant from going to the UIM carrier and posting the same medical bills and the same wages in his attempt to recover under UIM. Whereas here, at least under Harris and Donahoe and the other cases cited in Appellee's brief, you have Delaware decisional law that says, yeah, no, we don't want that. That's not part of our history. And I don't see anything in appellant's argument that would prohibit that. And that's
anything from the record in this case. There was $1 million that was paid.
Right.
Was any of that intended to address lost wages or medical expenses, or were there other elements of the claim that it was intended to address?
In the history of this case, I don't know. I don't believe there were.
Okay.
But
you agree it could have covered something else other than?
My argument is, if you overturn Harris, that is a very likely result, because I don't see anything standing in the way of it. If you're going to say that 2363E, if you're going to vitiate the workers' compensation carrier's right to go after anything but the tortfeasor's liability coverage, you're going to reverse your own well-thought-out analysis in Harris. And in doing so, you're going to open the door for all kinds of double recovery. And there's simply no need for it. I mean, what we didn't hear is a compelling case that that the way the law has been decided for years by this court is somehow promoting a completely dysfunctional system. It's not dysfunctional at all. There was UIM money available from the employer that was paid to the claimants in this case. It's not as if the workers' compensation carrier stood in the way of them getting recovery. It didn't. The workers' compensation carrier has a statutory lien. Appellant says, well, there's this little clause in the UIM policy that says no. And originally, that was their argument. And to the extent that that's still their argument, I would offer that there's no evidence, no case law, nothing that they've brought to this court that suggests that an exclusionary clause written in a UIM policy trumps 2363E. And to the extent that they're different insurance carriers, now you've got a situation where the workers' compensation carrier could not have waived its subrogation right because it didn't know that the employer was going out and buying UIM coverage with another carrier or that language was in there. The trial court at one point asked me about waiver, and I said, waiver doesn't enter into it. How can you waive it? other than the fact that somebody is, the employer is bargaining away the statutory right of the workers' compensation carrier by going out and purchasing what may be standard form language UIM from wherever, from whatever insurance company he's got.
Well, you do agree that the result in the case turns on who pays for the UIM coverage, correct?
I do.
Okay. And, I mean, if that is the case, then there's to be a different result if, on the one hand, the coverage is purchased and paid for by the employee, and on the other, by the employer, then there has to be some public policy rationale to justify that result.
Sure.
Since it isn't squarely addressed in the statute.
That's right.
What is the, what occurs to me, and I'm just asking for your reaction as to whether this is correct or off the mark, is that where the employee bargains for and purchases the UIM coverage, then that employee has a protectable expectation, a justifiable expectation in getting what it bargained for.
Right.
If it didn't bargain for that, it was done, the bargaining was done by the employee, then there's nothing unfair in denying that benefit to the employee because the employee had no justifiable expectation for something that it didn't bargain or pay for.
Right.
Is that the rationale that you're
That's
for?
Part of the rationale, sure. In the case where you have, say, let's say you have a male head of household employee who purchases UIM policy through private funds, and because he wants to create a level of protection for he and his family.
Before you move on,
yeah.
If that's the rationale for the distinction, then how do you handle the situation where the employee bargains as part of his or her package of compensation benefits that the employer will pick up UIM coverage? In other words, the bargaining there isn't done with the insurance company, but it's done with the employer.
Where the employee would pay a portion of the underinsured motorist premium?
The employee is bargaining with the employer for the terms of employment before the employee signs on to work for employer.
Okay.
One of the terms that's bargained for is salary.
Correct.
Another would be medical benefits. And a third, let's assume, would be a liability insurance package, including UIM. How is that case any different conceptually from the case where the employee bargains directly with his own insurance company?
I think it's different because when the employee bargains directly for his own insurance company, that policy becomes an asset of that man and his family. And it kicks in whether his son is hurt or maybe his wife is hurt or maybe he's hurt. And what this court in Adams said is, all right, well, if you're hurt on the job and you're getting workers' compensation and you're driving your employer's vehicle and you're getting workers' compensation insurance, the UIM asset of the employer that he bought for his fleet of vehicles is one thing. The asset that the employee bought for his family is quite another. And thing we're not going to allow.
You're using the word asset.
Yeah.
That's a property right, correct?
I think it is. Yeah.
All right. Well, isn't the employee's right to avail himself or herself of the UIM coverage paid for by the employer also a property right?
I think it's the employer's property right. He may be a beneficiary under it under certain circumstances, but I think if the employer bargains for and pays for that insurance policy.
So the common sense and the policy behind the distinction turns on whether you can call the UIM coverage an asset?
Well, the analogy that I was making I think that's part of it. Because I think what this court in Adams said, and I think rightfully so, is that we're not going to allow a workers' compensation carrier to subrogate its lien against an asset that belongs to a family, much like a car or a home or something like that. The workers' compensation carrier can't reach and say, well, now you have, we've got a lien against your home, so now you're going to sell your home because you were hurt on the job. No, but when an employer purchases a UIM policy, I think if you want to talk about property rights and assets, I think that's clearly the employer's, whether the employee is a falls into the category of a beneficiary of that or not. For instance, the employee could work for the employer for 5 years had he not made that, and let's suppose he doesn't make that a condition of his employment right from the outset. And 1 year the employer says, you know, I elected not to get UIM coverage on the vehicles. I don't see the need for it, and I don't have the money for it, and I don't have to do it. I don't think the employee says, well, I've got a property right to insist that you do. So I don't think that that's his property right. I don't think that that's his asset.
Bargain for contractual right. Why isn't it a property?
I mean, I've never seen that happen, but I'm not sure that. You mean specifically as a, in terms of a general negotiation along with? He says, I want this in medical benefits. I want, and I want to make sure that you have UIM coverage if I'm going to be driving that vehicle. I still think the asset and the property right belongs to the employer.
Do you agree, though, that the footnote 2 in Hearst, if read literally, is directly contrary to your position here?
Yes.
And if it is read literally, why isn't this a matter, if it is to be addressed or changed, for the General Assembly to do that?
Well, I think the General Assembly and this, I think this court has the power to, because the footnote is in a decision by this court. I think this court is certainly empowered to go back and say, this issue has come up in this case. We've looked at Harris. We've looked at our analysis. We've looked at the footnote in Hearst. And what we mean, what we meant to say in the footnote in Hearst is, as it pertains to Title 21, 2118. I don't know anything that would prohibit this court from doing that, and I actually that's probably part of the relief that I'm requesting that this court do, because I don't think there's any way, upon a careful reading, when you go back and you look at the 1993 amendment, you look at the language that backs up what I think is a very well written opinion in Harris, and you take the part of 2363E that Harris relies upon, and it's still there. It was never affected by the 1993 amendment. It was completely not changed at all. What was changed was specifically to bring the, as a matter of fundamental fairness and continuity, the right of the workers' compensation carrier and its subrogation against the plaintiff's recovery to be in line with what the plaintiff himself or herself could recover. And that's all it does. And that doesn't affect the any recovery language that Harris relied upon so dearly, and I think correctly. And that's really the rub when you're looking at Hearst and what that footnote means, and you go back to the 1993 amendment, you see that, all right, well, clearly the legislature did not disturb any of the language upon which we've already decided this case, this issue rather, in Harris. What did it change? And then you find that it changed just in accordance with the PIP statute. That's my analysis, and I think it's the correct analysis of the 1993 amendment. And I think there's more persuasive evidence that because the State Assembly did only one other thing in that session, which was to change the PIP statute to be in accordance with 2363 as well. So you didn't have a disconnect between the two statutes. I see my time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd just like to make four quick points in rebuttal. In response to Justice Ridgely's question, although $1 million was paid, there were two plaintiffs in this case, and just so, you know, not, it's not critical to the court's analysis, but my client was paid $430,000 of that $1 million, and the other, because the other widow, because she had more children, was paid $570,000 of that money. The Hearst decision was decided 17 years ago, and I do have to correct Mr. McKenty, because Hearst wasn't the case, and Hearst did involve workers' compensation. In fact, the argument that the employer made was that there was a workers' compensation lien of about $45,000, as I recollect, and there was a $40,000 company UM policy, and then there was a $50,000 personal UM policy, and the argument was, can the comp carrier, the employer UM carrier take credit for the $40,000 that they paid my client to offset the tax?
Well, I think the question that Mr. McKinney was raising was whether the statement in footnote 2 was a holding or dictum.
Well, yeah, as Justice Holland pointed out, I believe that 17 years have gone by. Everybody's known about this decision, and Hearst is certainly an en banc decision, a fairly important decision.
Was it a holding or was it dictum?
I believe it absolutely was a holding, Your Honor.
There was an issue raised.
Well,
in that case,
it's workers' comp was involved in Hearst.
Was there a workers' comp lien that was asserted against the proceeds of a?
I believe if the court looks at the facts of that case, there was, and in fact, the employer took the position that the $40,000 in UM paid, they had the right to offset that against the comp lien that they had already paid for the benefits to my client.
And what were the merits of that position litigated in the Supreme Court?
Hearst focused on the reducing provision because the argument that the
were the merits of that position litigated in the Supreme Court?
I don't believe the merits of was that lien valid in accordance with the argument we're making here.
Argued in the Supreme Court.
I don't believe it was, Your Honor, but it did involve workers' compensation insurance. The other issue I would two other arguments I'd like to make to the court. There clearly is no double recovery in this case, and because my client, who lost her husband,
would it matter if there were double recovery?
It doesn't matter in the least, and you know why it doesn't matter, Your Honor? Because it happens all the time. There are
in
double.
In other words, you don't dispute Mr. McKinney's argument that your side's interpretation would permit a double recovery.
Correct, and I think
you're saying that may be, but.
That's right, but the purposes of the coverage are different. My client is only, had this comp lien not exist, my client would only be getting $600 and some per week for death benefits. There are multiple other damages that she would be entitled to that aren't present in the comp statute. But irrespective of that, double recoveries happen all the time, and there's nothing wrong with a double recovery. And in fact, this court has said over and over and over again that a double recovery is appropriate. And in the Adams case, again, I read the part of the provision where this court specifically said the language of that policy provision trumps 2363. And that's what it said, the part that I read the court. And if there is a double recovery, double recoveries are permitted. And I think the hypothetical that I gave the court earlier about what happens if one of your honors is in someone else's car and you're in the course and scope of your employment, an injury occurs. Does the comp carrier then have the right to say, well, wait a minute, you didn't pay for that coverage. We have the right to offset against that policy. And if Mr. McKinney is right, they do. And I submit to you, that makes no sense because that happens every – there are hundreds of uninsured motorist cases where people are in someone else's car, an uninsured or underinsured driver causing an accident, whether it's a relative, whether it's a kid from school. In this particular case, let's suppose that Mr. Sternfels and Mr. The other gentleman's name picked up someone on the side of the road and drove them back, and then this collision occurs. Wouldn't that person be entitled to a portion of these $1 million uninsured motorist benefits because they happened to be in the car at the time? They didn't pay for that coverage. And clearly under Delaware case law, they'd be entitled to make that claim, and it happens all the time. And no one else pays for that coverage except for the person that's buying that premium. And I do think, as it was asked and commented upon, this could have been a risk that was bargained for. You don't know, and we don't know, why they selected $1 million worth of insurance. On all DART buses now, there is no uninsured motorist coverage. It's been rejected for 15 or 20 years now. But in this particular case, it was bargained for. It was purchased by someone, whether the owner of Connections, whether the board of directors of Connections, to protect their employees. And that bargain for insurance has a value. And whether my client paid the premium, someone paid the premium, and I think the court is going to have to deal with the issue of how is it okay to have an offset if it's just the employer's insurance versus everybody else in the state of Delaware who happens to be in somebody else's car that didn't pay for that premium. And I think that's the dilemma that the defendant has, and I think that that's why the primary reason why the court should reverse the decision. And I think that's all I have. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.